prospect of hanging could concentrate even Nova Terran's thoughts. What a pity nothing short of that could do the trick. "I'm aware of the Navy's feeble excuse that the bugs entered through an unknown warp point," she continued. "I am also aware that you are now departing with large forces, leaving Alpha Centauri undefended, naked before these murderous alien hordes. As a member of the Naval Oversight Committee, I promise you there will be a full investigation of your failure to defend the civilian populace of this system."
"If I squash this Sloloki as she deserves, it will only serve her own ends," Antonov told himself, and forced his deep, rumbling voice to remain calm and reasonable. "Since you are aware of so much else, Assemblywoman Wister, you must be aware that we have taken steps to secure this system against attack, and that additional reinforcements have already been ordered by Sky Marshal Avram herself to join Admiral MacGregor," he indicated the woman beside him, "here in Centauri in my absence."
"Nor will the inquiry stop there," Wister raved on without a break. She was pleased to note the expression on the Orion's face. As a rule, she despised the Orions who had invaded Centauri since the Alliance's activation, almost as much as her own militarists. But such a broad, toothy smile could only be one of sympathy and encouragement. "We will have answers, Admiral. Answers to the larger question of why the Navy, in well over 2 years of war, has not wiped out these inhuman monsters to the last foul creature. There will be a thorough house-cleaning of
Major Lin."
It wasn't so much Antonov's increased volume that caused Wister to stop short. It was more a kind of subliminal, almost subterranean vibration in his bass voice.
"Sir," the Marine Major in charge of security hurried over and snapped to attention. "Major, this area is to be cleared at once. The entire building is off limits to unauthorized personnel until further notice from Lord Talfon. Now get this pista out of here."
Lin gulped. He'd been around Ivan the Terrible long enough to know that what the Admiral had called Wister was the equivalent of an English speaker's use of the word asshole. But he also knew that the idiom, used without regard to the gender of the individual in question, translated literally as cunt. Luckily, Wister's blank look suggested she was unaware of that fact.
"Yes, sir," he rapped.
Antonov started to turn to go, then paused with the movement half completed. When he spoke, his voice was mild again.
"You know, Miss Wister, there is a mistaken proverb which tells us that those who are ignorant of the past are condemned to repeat it. In fact, they're lucky if they're allowed to repeat it. More probably, they're condemned to something even worse than the past. This is doubly true of those who believe that their ignorance somehow makes them morally superior to those who don't share it."
He turned back and faced Wister squarely, looking at her as he might have looked at something disgusting in a plate of food.
"I go now to lead brave men and women into what will be, for many of them, death. They go willingly, out of devotion to a state which, unfortunately, is not worthy of it. But, as someone once said, it is the quality of the passion that matters, not its object."
He turned on his heel and strode away through a thundering silence. Behind him, Bettina Wister held her head high as she was led away. It was a lovely image for the cameras, she thought, a small, harmless, civilian woman between two huge, hard-faced Marine guards. It was even more than she'd hoped for, and she hid her triumph behind an expression of outraged dignity, already considering the most effective way for her staffers to cut and edit the recordings. The Type K0V orange primary star of this system, its remote red dwarf companion, was quite invisible, reflected feebly from the flanks of Second Fleet's ships. Ivan Antonov stood on TFNS Colorado's flag bridge and gazed at the viewscreen. One volume of space was much like any other, he supposed, but there was something special about this particular expanse of nothingness, for he was looking at original pre-war bug space. He was the first human since Commodore Lloyd Braun to look on such space, and the first ever to look on it as a conqueror. Admiral Vandergelder's Task Force 22 had led the way through the warp point from Alpha Centauri, behind the new fourth-generation SBM Hawks that had blasted a path through the warp point covering force, including the gunboats, whose point defense was useless against the sprint-mode missiles the new pods could carry. Raymond Prescott had transited in her wake. His Task Force 21 included his own veteran light carrier force from the Kleon campaign, as well as the cream of the new construction fast super dreadnoughts and refitted battlecruisers. It was like a weapon forged for his hand, and he'd wielded it like a kendo master. He'd swept around behind the defenders and driven them into the waiting jaws of Vandegelder's battle line and Vice Admiral Tathanak's fighters, many of them Ophiuchi piloted and operating from the new assault carriers, and the bugs hadn't stood a chance. They died with their usual horrifying obliviousness to personal survival, inflicting whatever damage they could on an enemy who possessed the prohibitive fire control advantages of Command Data Link. And now Antonov stood in the midst of a fleet that was verging on euphoria at the lightness of its losses, waiting for the reports from the drones that had sped on ahead to spy out the system he'd already dubbed Anderson One, in honor of his old friend.
"We're getting preliminary readings, Admiral," Blanton Stovall spoke from behind him. "No indication of any habitation. All the planets are useless rock balls or gas giants anyway."
Antonov tried not to show his disappointment.
"Too bad the first conquered bug system should turn out to be an undistinguished accumulation of cosmic detritus."
"Come, Vanya," he chided himself. "What did you expect?
To transit from Alpha Centauri directly into the capital system of the Tsar of all the bugs." "One lucky break. We think we've already inferred the general location of one warp point," Stovall went on. "It's in the inner system, which is why the drones picked it up so quickly while looking for life-bearing planets. We're putting it on the display now."
Antonov turned to the holotank, in which the system's features were winking to life as fast as their existence was confirmed. The icon of a warp point had begun to blink off and on, fairly close to the system primary.
"The search for warp points must take first priority," he rumbled. "We must secure this system against counterattack as quickly as possible."
Stovall nodded in understanding. The bugs, by fighting to the last ship and not even attempting to flee, had deprived them of any indication of where more of their kind might be expected to appear. This newly discovered warp point might be the gateway to the enemy's heartland, or it might not, and any pickets at other warp points would, of course, have departed by now, before anyone was close enough to detect their departure.
"We'll be prepared to act on any data we receive, sir," Stovall said confidently. "Now that Admiral Chin's fleet train has transited from Centauri, our post-battle repairs are well in hand."
"Good. Keep me informed of any—"
"Admiral," Armand de Bertolet's voice came from the flag bridge's comm station, where he leaned over an operator's shoulder.
"New reports from the inward-bound drones indicate, well, you can see for yourself in the tank."
Antonov did. A short distance outward from the inner system warp point, but still almost 6 light hours from Second Fleet, tiny red icons were popping out like smallpox.
"Bogies," Stovall said unnecessarily.
"Quite a few of them," added Midori Kozlov, joining them. "They can't have already been in this system." "Of course not," de Bertolet said emphatically. "Their vector shows they've come from that inner warp point, and if their velocities held constant, they must have emerged from it," he fiddled with his wrist calculator, "just as we were mopping up the last of the defense force."
"Good timing from our standpoint," Stovall put in dryly.
"But I don't know how valid that constant velocity assumption is," Kozlov said. "They're moving at what has to be the pace of their slowest ships. They're also keeping a very tight formation, from what we can tell. All in all, I'd say they're advancing very cautiously."
"Wouldn't you, in their place?"
De Bertolet's rhetorical question was almost challenging. For reasons doubtless related to his upbringing, he had a way of carrying off remarks that in anyone else would have sounded like sheer bravado. Even his appearance helped. He always kept within grooming and uniform standards, but he still managed to have the kind of looks that had once been called Byronic, a word whose root no one remembered. He turned to Antonov and Stovall, body language fairly shouting urgency.
"Admiral, we must engage them without delay!"
I think we should amend that to without unnecessary delay, Commander, Stovall spoke in mild reproof. We've still got some repairs in progress, and I believe we can afford to complete them. Get me reports from the ships in question, Commodore Stovall, Antonov ordered. Also, whatever data the drones can provide on this force's composition. Like you, I'd rather complete repairs before we advance, but the important thing is getting those Svoloki out of this system.
And so, Midori Koslov concluded her presentation. Before the bug force departed through the warp point, we were able to make a definitive estimate of its composition, at least by mass equivalence. 42 super dreadnoughts, 10 battlecruisers, and 30 light cruisers.
A considerable force, de Bertolet commented. Still distinctly inferior to ours, even without our tech advantages. Small wonder they fell back when we advanced.
What about the warp point? Antonov growled.
Pinpointed, sir, Stovall reported. A fast-covering force has been dispatched there as per your orders.
All right, Antonov swept the staff meeting with his eyes.
So we're now sitting on the warp point the bugs used to enter this system. What about our search for still more warp points?
No results as yet, sir, but there wouldn't be at this point. We'll need time for some extensive survey work to satisfy ourselves that there are no more open warp points.
Stovall paused and gave a wry half-smile.
And, of course, there's no telling about closed warp points. But that's true anywhere, as we've all been reminded lately.
Very well.
Antonov turned to Koslov.
Commodore, what is your interpretation of the astrographic and military situation in which we find ourselves?
Well, sir, the military situation is that we've secured this system at very little cost, and that the force the bugs put into it was so inadequate to face us that it withdrew, rather than follow their usual practice of accepting extravagant losses if any appreciable damage can be inflicted in exchange. It seems probable that the force was the only one they could put into this system. If they could have deployed enough strength to stop us, they surely would have. This in turn suggests we're in a rather lightly defended area.
Which won't remain lightly defended, Stovall put in grimly.
Exactly my own conclusions, Antonov stated. So now I wish to pose the following question. Should we proceed deeper into bug space?
He looked around and decided he'd better recognize the operations officer before he burst.
Commander de Bertolet.
I think, Admiral, that we've been given a priceless opportunity. De Bertolet leaned forward as though to physically impart greater force to his words. But it's an opportunity that won't last. As Commodore Stovall has pointed out, the bugs must have sent for reinforcements. We've caught them off balance, but we must press on without hesitation before they've had time to regain that balance. This is a crucial moment in history.
Now hold on, Commander, Stovall spoke in his slow, deliberate way, rather like a harmonica following a trumpet. Let's not forget we're in an unsurveyed system. We don't have the slightest idea where we are.
With great respect, Commodore, we do know one thing, because the bugs themselves told us. De Bertolet indicated the conference room's small replica of the Flagbridge's holotank. By falling back through that warp point, they showed us the way to what they consider most vital to defend, which can only be their centers of population and industry. That's sheer inference, Koslov protested. But a reasonable one, de Bertolet shot back. Why would they have withdrawn into some dead-end warp chain? And why would they have been there in the first place? Remember, they emerged from that same warp point.
Stovall shook his head slowly. I don't know, Admiral. Let's not let success go to our heads. It's true that we didn't have many outright ship losses, but a fair number of our ships took varying degrees of damage, and Admiral Tathanak lost a lot of fighters when he entered the bug's defensive envelope. We'll want to replace those losses.
Of course, sir, de Bertolet conceded. But as soon as those matters are seen to, we should advance without further delay. This opportunity is absolutely unique.
So are the potential dangers, Koslov argued. Until we've thoroughly surveyed this system, we can't be sure there are no other warp points. And if there are, there's no guarantee they lead to dead-end warp chains, as some of us are assuming a little too readily. We'd be leaving ourselves vulnerable to being cut off from our base by an attack from an unexpected direction.
De Bertolet's face darkened a half-shade, but his self-control was unimpeachable. I can't deny that what I'm proposing contains an element of risk, Commodore. But if we insist on a total absence of risk, we'll never move at all. As Commodore Stovall intimated, there could be closed warp points here, and no amount of surveying will ever reveal them. It didn't at Centauri, and we've been there almost 300 years. He stopped abruptly, and no one else spoke, for they all knew Antonov well enough to recognize the brooding look he'd assumed. It meant he was through listening to advice or arguments, and had assumed the burden of decision that none of them could share.
"Well, Vanya, now's when you earn your salary."
For a moment he allowed himself to wish he had Kathara with him, but then he dismissed the thought. After all, he knew exactly what the frosted sable Orion would say. "Attack!" And, he thought with growing conviction, Kathara would be right. Antonov was far from unaware of the danger of a victorious force letting its elan do its thinking for it, and de Berthollet was by nature the very voice of elan. But his point, stripped of the theatrics, was compelling. For the first time they had the initiative. It was worth taking terrifying risks to keep it. And yet, his thoughts came back to the conference room, and his eyes met those of his staff.
"Commodore Stovall," he rumbled, "proceed to implement repairs. Make arrangements to begin probing the system beyond this warp point with recon drones, and commence operational planning for a full-scale advance through the warp point after those repairs are completed and our fighter strength is replenished."
He studied their reactions. De Berthollet could scarcely contain his elation, and Kosloff looked glum. But Stovall's worried look seemed no more than what he knew was expected of him. He was no more capable of not wanting to press on through that beckoning warp point than he was of not voicing all possible objections to it.
"And," Antonov continued, "while we're in the process of ferrying fighters from Alpha Centauri, I myself will be returning there briefly to put my proposed course of action before the Joint Chiefs."
For a moment he let himself enjoy their expressions of almost comical surprise.
"Yes, I'm sure it seems out of character, but consider, if Commodore Kosloff's nightmare of a flank attack on this system through an undiscovered warp point comes to pass, while Second Fleet is off somewhere deeper in Bug space, the Bugs will be one warp transit away from Centauri, two from Sol, and Old Terra."
He gauged their expressions again. They were surprisingly alike, and he wondered what these disparate people had felt at the words Old Terra. Stovall? Indian summer in the Alleghenies, perhaps. De Berthollet? Surely a montage of images from what historians called the Cavalry Revolution and romanticists knew as the Age of Chivalry. Kosloff? Hard to say. But for all of them, as for every member of the far-scattered progeny of Adam and Eve, it meant something inexpressibly holy. Not that anyone would have dreamed of putting it that way. Antonov shook his head heavily.
"No, there are some decisions which no one has a right to make alone."
"I gather, Admiral Antonov, that your staff was divided on the question."
"True, Fleet Speaker Noraku," Antonov acknowledged. He permitted himself a tight smile.
"It would be remarkable if they hadn't been. I picked them with that in mind. I want lively debate, not sycophancy. My chief of staff, Captain Stovall, is cautious and deliberate by temperament, so I sought out an operations officer with opposite inclinations."
"Ah, yes," Kathara nodded. "The young commander with the totally unpronounceable name. I like him."
"You would," Hannah Avram remarked. Strictly speaking, she wasn't a member of the Joint Chiefs, but to not invite her to this meeting would have been out of the question. She turned to Antonov.
"Yes, your commander de Berthollet does seem to be a firebrand, but I think he, and you, Ivan Nikolaevich, are right about pressing on with Pesthouse, especially now that Ellen's reinforcements have arrived here at Centauri. Even if the enemy does break into Anderson 1 behind you, this system will be secure."
"Agreed," said Admiral Tharzan. "Still it is a gamble. Second Fleet would be advancing into unknown space with no notion of the forces it may
face. Come, we have already been over the arguments.
Kathara's voice was impatient.
Second Fleet's tactical speed advantage should suffice for it to disengage if it finds itself faced with a force too strong to fight. Of course, we cannot ignore the potential threat to this system and to the human homeworld. But Sky Marshal Avram is confident she and Admiral MacGregor can guarantee their security. In fact, she and our chairman, both of whom are human, favor the operation.
He paused for the barest heartbeat.
There comes a time when we must not let risks blind us to opportunities, especially when the opportunity is a fleeting one.
I concur, Noraku stated.
As do I,
Tharzan said, a little less emphatically. Antonov settled back in his chair with a silent sigh. So it was settled. Second Fleet would forge on into the unknown.
Thank you, he said with unwonted quietness. I would not have been able to embark wholeheartedly on this without your unanimous support.
He rose to his feet.
And now I must make preparations to return to Anderson One without delay. The offensive must commence as soon as our repair and resupply operations are complete.
Kathara gave a short growl.
Naturally, our chairman is eager as an unleashed Zegat to return and reassume the command to which he has appointed himself.
Avram laughed, and Noraku and Tharzan gave their respective races equivalent indicia of amusement as the tension evaporated. Antonov smiled, all innocence.
But, Kthara Kornazovich, it is my plan. Surely you must agree that I should be the one to put it into effect.
Kathara gave him a baleful look.
Trust you to come up with such an argument, Ivan Zartan.
He stood and faced his Vilkshatha brother.
Yes, I understand perfectly. And while you are gone, I shall busy myself thinking of an appropriate way to make you pay for your practice of leaving me behind to handle all the boring administrative work. You have always had a tendency to... What is the human idiom?
Pull rank, Avram supplied.
Now, Kthasha, Antonov soothed, there'll be plenty of fighting for everyone before this is over. And don't be like this. It's not as though you're never going to see me again.
And with a jauntiness that was somehow not inappropriate despite his age, Antonov was gone. Chapter 35. What else are we to do? Jessica Vandegelder's super-dreadnoughts emerged into the new system amid the final reverberations of the SBM Hawk-spawned Holocaust among its warp-point defenses. Antonov wasn't advancing into the altogether unknown. RD-2s had established that this system was heavily populated, which tended to confirm the conclusions de Berthollet had drawn from the Bugs Avenue of retreat. They'd also provided enough data on the defenders to satisfy Antonov that his fleet train's SBM Hawk inventory would suffice to blast a path through them. Now he stood on Colorado's flag bridge as the super-dreadnought advanced in Vandegelder's formation. He wasn't about to depart from a tradition which dated back to the First Interstellar War. The Supreme Commander would go in with the first waves, and saw that view confirmed. Some of the dying glows of SBM Hawk warheads were actually visible to the naked eye in the expanding clouds of vaporized metal they'd wrought, and the holotank told an ever-elaborating tale of smashed or crippled fortresses. Extensive minefields remained, but Second Fleet's AMBAMs had already cleared paths through them. TF-22 forged ahead, and Admiral Tathanak's TF-23 was already beginning transit. Soon, Raymond Prescott would bring TF-21 through, but Antonov, staring fixedly at the holotank, had eyes only for the scarlet icons in Second Fleet's path.
Commodore Kozlov, he rumbled without shifting his eyes, have you been able to reach any conclusions regarding the mobile bug forces?
Yes, sir. Now that our leading elements have begun to exchange fire with them, we're getting harder data. These have to be the same ones that withdrew from Anderson One just ahead of us. The force composition by ship classes is an exact match. Too exact for coincidence.
"So they haven't been reinforced yet," de Bertolet breathed. "We've caught them still trying to mobilize against us. This force is still all they can put in our path. It must be under orders to stand and fight this time, because this is an inhabited system."
He turned to Antonov, his excitement barely under control.
"Admiral, this could be the beginning of the end of the war. If we can continue to advance, continue to keep them off balance..."
"Excuse me, Admiral."
Kosloff didn't often interrupt de Bertolet, and something in her tone caused even Antonov to turn away from the plot to face her. "We're starting to get some disturbing tactical analyses from the ships most heavily engaged. They're receiving precisely coordinated time-on-target fire from as many as 6 bug ships at once." The silence lasted less than a heartbeat before de Bertolet broke it.
But that's as many ships as one of our own battle groups. Do you mean to suggest—"
"I'm not the one suggesting it, Commander. The data speak for themselves."
She jerked her chin toward the tank and the mid-air columns of luminous figures that told the tale of damage well beyond what they'd allowed for at this stage of the engagement. "And," she continued,
"why should it be such a surprise? Admiral LeBlanc's been telling anyone who'll listen that it was only a matter of time. The bugs have seen Command Data Link in action often enough, and it doesn't require any basic technology beyond their demonstrated horizons. It's just that we've come to take our monopoly for granted, as though it were somehow in the nature of things."
"Thank you, Commodore," Stovall cut in quietly but authoritatively. He understood her accumulated frustration at the immemorial reluctance of line officers to listen to the intelligence community until after its forecasts had become fact. But this wasn't the time for her to get uncharacteristically worked up about it. "Admiral, we can defer interpreting these data until later. But it's clear that, at a minimum, our projections have erred on the optimistic side where bug fire control is concerned. Should we implement our contingency plan for breaking off engagement?" "Yet," Antonov's voice held absolutely no invitation to debate. "Signal Admiral Vandegelder to press her attack with maximum aggressiveness, and raise Admiral Tathanak as soon as he's transited. It is imperative that he begin launching fighter strikes as quickly as possible." He met his staffer's eyes, each in turn. The Theban War lay beyond living memory for their generation, and day-to-day contact tends to rub away the patina of legendary. But all at once the tales they'd grown up on came crowding back, for this was the man who had advanced through every defense like an unstoppable force of nature, grimly disregarding casualties as he gained his objectives, and the nickname Ivan the Terrible. All at once, those tales seemed very real.
"Aye, aye, sir," Stovall said quietly.
Antonov turned back to the tank and watched Vandegelder's task force advance into a holocaust of fire unprecedented in its intensity. It soon became apparent that at least a dozen of the bug super dreadnoughts belonged to the missile-heavy Archer class. Even with the defensive firepower of her new SDEs, Vandegelder didn't relish missile duels with 6-ship battle groups of those behemoths. She ordered her ships to close to beam range while trying to stay outside the zone in which plasma guns were truly deadly. It was a difficult balancing act, performed while nervously awaiting the onset of gunboats on suicide runs. But no kamikaze attacks came, and the reason became apparent when Tathanak's fighters entered the fray. The bugs, perhaps out of confidence in the way their new data link technology enhanced their firepower, had held the gunboats back as anti-fighter escorts, adding their loads of AFHAWKs to the tremendous defensive fire from the tight enemy formations. Losses continued to mount, and periodically Colorado, fighting in TF-22's battle line, shuddered for a sickening instant. Calls for damage control began to reverberate through the great ship, but Antonov never flinched. He held grimly to the rail that surrounded the holotank and stared at the battle the tank revealed, as though it was a living being with which he was in silent communion, broken only to bark occasional orders. Finally, the balance commenced to tilt. Ships continued to emerge from the warp point, as did the reserve SBM Hawks, which came under the control of Fleet Command. Their firepower and Second Fleet's overall numerical superiority began to tell. Almost abruptly, the bugs broke off in an orderly retreat,
and Vandergelder's shaken task force left the job of harrying that retreat to Tathanach's already weary fighter pilots and Prescott's newly arrived ones.
"Admirals Tathanach and Prescott both report heavy fighter losses," Stovall reported, as the fighting receded out of missile range and a palpable air of relief suffused Colorado.
"The volume of anti-fighter missile fire seems unabated."
"It will abate as the attacks continue to be pressed." Antonov was as impervious to the flagship's new mood as he had been to the earlier tension. "Their magazines aren't infinite, and the attacks must be pressed without let-up. Make that very clear to Tathanach and Prescott. Losses are secondary. We have nearby sources of reinforcement, which they apparently do not."
Stovall swallowed hard.
"Aye, aye, sir. Oh, and one other thing, Commodore. As soon as practicable, I want recon drones dispatched sunward. We already know there's a planet here that's a high-energy population center. It must be quite close to a dim sun like this one. We will, of course, proceed there as soon as the bug forces are cleared from the system."
"You mean, sir?"
"Yes."
Antonov's expression was absolutely unreadable.
"Our orders are clear. We are about to become the first in well over a century to implement General Directive 18.
The staff conference room had a wall screen. Antonov had decreed that it be left on, and eyes kept straying to the planet Harna. Everyone was calling it that by now, even though this system had officially been named Anderson II. Beyond the world's blue curve was the bone-white crescent of its moon. That moon, like the oxygen-rich atmosphere, represented a triumph over the odds. Harna orbited just outside the zone in which the orange sun's tidal force would have stopped the planet's rotation and stripped away any natural satellites, but close enough to that relatively feeble fusion furnace for water to exist as a liquid in which life could arise.
"And why do you keep letting your mind wander into this astronomical blackgardonost, Vanya?"
Antonov unflinchingly answered his own question.
"Because you'd rather think about that, or anything at all, than about what you found here on this lovely blue planet."
Things had gone according to plan. Task Forces 21 and 23 had herded the bugs out of the system with relentless fighter strikes. They'd never broken that dense defensive formation, but the bugs had withdrawn minus a quarter of their capital ships and most of their light cruisers. Better still, the warp point through which they'd done their withdrawing had been pinpointed and was now heavily guarded against any counterstroke. Meanwhile, TF-22 had proceeded behind a cloud of recon drones following the spoor of that which the Great Alliance had condemned to death. They'd been prepared for swarms of gunboats to rise from the planet in suicidal fury. Yet none had. There were only orbital defenses, fortresses and the kind of elaborate military-industrial faculties one would expect around a highly developed planet. Antonov had waited until some of the other task force's carrier formations had joined him, then finished off the orbital works with SBM Hawk bombardments and fighter strikes. And the planet had lain open to them with its 2 or 3 billion bugs. And something else. The wait for the carriers hadn't been a very long one, but it had allowed time for an extensive survey of the surface. In the course of mapping targets, one of Midori Kosloff's subordinates had noticed vast enclosures that were clearly stockyards for meat animals, six-legged vertebrates like all the planet's higher land fauna. But something had bothered him, a wrongness he couldn't quite put his finger on. Kosloff hadn't been able to put her finger on it either, at first. She demanded greater and greater magnifications of the imagery. No one could ever forget the moment when the screen had shown one of the meat animals, the foremost third of its body held erect, making marks on the wall of a shed with a crude implement held in one of its forefeet. After the planet's sky had been cleared of all opposition, more detailed reconnaissance had commenced, using oral sensors that were the highly evolved descendants of an earlier century's shotgun mics. And they'd all watched the meat animals, most of them almost reverted to a hexapedal habit, go about their rudimentary socialization under the leadership of the class that had somehow halted their degradation just short of the loss of writing.
The computers were still trying to crack the spoken language and had analyzed a few of the sounds. One of those sounds was Harna for world. And so it had become in the minds of the horror-stricken humans who gazed at the overgrown ruins of what had clearly been cities, occasionally adorned with sculptures of the proud centauroids who'd built them. Kosloff's self-consciously flinty voice roused Antonov from his reverie. She hadn't been the only one to turn green around the gills as realization dawned. In retrospect, perhaps the discovery was inevitable. In every other sense, it had been unthinkable. Justin and Cleon had told the Grand Alliance the bugs regarded them as food sources, yet some deep-seated part of the Alliance's analysts had seen that as an act of opportunity, like the pre-space practices of strip mining or clear-cutting watersheds. The notion that even bugs would actually raise sentient beings as a self-sustaining herd of meat animals had not occurred to them. Perhaps, Antonov reflected grimly, simply because it was so utterly unacceptable.
There's no room for doubt, Kosloff was telling the staff and various senior officers. They're the descendants of the city builders, the original inhabitants of Harna. Indications are that their civilization was no more advanced than early 20th century Earth's. Vacuum tube electronics and hydrocarbon burning internal combustion engines. They never stood a chance when the bugs arrived.
Raymond Prescott shook his head slowly.
Are you sure? I mean, he gestured vaguely, and they all knew what he meant, for they'd all watched the occupants of those vast, fetid, dung-choked pens as they shuffled listlessly about. Quite sure, Admiral Prescott. Granted, they're incredibly degraded. We have no way of knowing how long they've been livestock. Quite a while from the condition of the ruins. But they're still sentient. They haven't had time to evolve away from it. Even though the capacity to feel such things as rebelliousness must be decidedly contra-survival in their circumstances.
So, Stovall said in the voice of a man trying to awake from nightmare, they know that they're going to be...
Yes, Kosloff nodded jerkily. Her color was poor, and her voice was that of a machine. There will have been a strong natural selection in favor of those willing to go on living and bringing forth offspring as a domesticated food source.
They were all silent for a few heartbeats, each of them alone in hell with the newfound knowledge that there are worse things than extinction. But they weren't really alone at all, for the human inhabitants of the bug-occupied worlds seemed to fill the room. Finally, Antonov cleared his throat. In that silence, it was like a thunderclap.
Thank you, Commodore Kosloff. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we must consider the effect of these findings on our plans to carry out General Directive 18.
De Bertolet's head jerked upward, as though emerging from his private vision of horror.
Admiral, I don't understand. Surely no one now can doubt the wisdom of reactivating the directive.
The sick look on his face began to give way to one of fury.
The universe must be cleansed of these monsters. We're dealing with an abomination beyond humanity's conception of evil. By comparison, Hitler was a naughty boy. The Rigelians mildly maladjusted.
Agreed, Commander. But the Harnahis present a complicating factor. There are, Commodore Kosloff estimates, several million of them scattered among the bug billions. It isn't always easy to tell just where they are, for the ranches where they're bred are interspersed with those devoted to raising other, lower animal species native to this planet.
He leaned forward, and his voice dropped to a basso fit for a Mussorgsky chorus.
I am under orders to exterminate the bugs wherever I find them, but I am neither ordered nor authorized to commit genocide upon another sentient race. And I am disinclined to do so, especially in this case.
He smiled slightly.
The older one gets, the harder it becomes to believe in any kind of universal ethical balance. Divine justice, if you will. But one doesn't like to take chances, and should I happen to be wrong in my skepticism, well, if anyone in the universe has suffered enough, the Harnahis have.
Stovall broke the awkward silence that followed.
"Admiral, the fact remains that we, like all Alliance forces, are subject to the general order to extirpate all bug populations. And the Harnahy's presence here poses a moral dilemma only if we limit our tactical options to scorching the surface clean of life. Perhaps there are other alternatives."
"I've considered those alternatives, Commodore. General Nagata, please summarize our discussion on the subject."
Brigadier Heinrich Nagata, the senior Marine officer embarked with Second Fleet, came unconsciously to a seated position of attention.
"Sir, ever since Justin, we've known how tough the bugs can be in a ground action. And this is the first time we've ever contemplated fighting them on the surface of a long-established planet of theirs, with hundreds of millions of workers available to soak up fire."
He paused awkwardly, unaccustomed to presenting arguments against going in. But he plowed ahead.
"Second Fleet, as presently constituted, doesn't even incorporate a real landing force. We didn't anticipate needing one. With the reactivation of General Directive 18, it was assumed that any bug-inhabited worlds would simply be smashed from orbit. All I've got are the ship's regular marine detachments. There's simply no way I could hope to go down there and selectively wipe out 3 billion bugs while preserving the Harnahy's."
Kozlov looked up in agony.
"We're only 2 transits from Alpha Centauri, 3 from Sol. Maybe we could bring in more surface forces."
"You're talking about Marines, Commodore," Nagata snapped. "Do you have any conception of how many of them would die, even if we brought in the whole damned Corps?"
"I'm sorry, Brigadier. I know what they'd have to face. But what else are we to do?"
Antonov's voice cut the exchange off like a battle axe.
"That cannot be our decision. A policy is going to have to be hammered out for dealing with this world, and others like it. Our surprise is merely a result of wishful thinking. We should have anticipated such situations."
"How could we have, Admiral?" Tathanak asked quietly. "Admittedly, we have all had to accustom ourselves to what the bugs do to the inhabitants of conquered worlds. But the notion of sentient beings raised from birth as..."
He couldn't continue. It was the first time any of them had seen the avian lose his composure.
"I suppose," Raymond Prescott grated, "we've simply assumed, had to assume, that the bugs gorged on the conquered human populations until they'd finished them off. We never let ourselves consider that they were keeping some as breeding stock. Children, probably."
A low sound, more primal than any spoken language, suffused the compartment. Antonov cut it off.
"For present, I have decided how we will proceed."
They all noticed the loss of definite articles. A few knew him well enough to realize the stress level that implied.
"Commodore Stovall, I want staff to plan surgical strikes aimed at destroying all spaceport facilities and major industrial centers and military installations on surface, as well as any remaining space-based industry. And no, I don't expect you to guarantee these strikes won't kill a single Harnahy's. Only a politician could be so fatuous. We'll strand Harna's bug population on planet, where it can be left to await Alliance's decision. Our next courier drone will inform Centauri of this course of action, and of my assumption of full responsibility for it."
He stood up abruptly and stalked out of the room before the rest of them could rise. They were left staring at the view screen, at the lovely blue planet. "Yes, Admiral Antonov, the Joint Chiefs, with Sky Marshal Avram's hearty concurrence, fully endorse your handling of the Harna problem. They wish me to convey that to you in the most emphatic terms." Rear Admiral Jamal Moreno beamed at Antonov. He'd only just arrived at the head of reinforcements that included factory-like repair ships, even more welcome than the warships to a heavily damaged Second Fleet.
"So," Stovall asked, "have they decided what to do about Harna?"
He, de Berthollet, and Kozlov sat with the 2 admirals, bathed in the simulated ruddy light of Anderson II's primary. One entire bulkhead of Colorado's flag lounge was a hollow projection, and the cozy compartment seemed open to space in a way that someone from an earlier era would have found disconcerting. Not yet, Moreno told him. They're still thrashing out the problem. It's hoped that genetic engineering may provide the answer, a tailored virus that's deadly to bugs but harmless to indigenous Harnahee's life. They want me to bring back biological samples, which shouldn't be hard to obtain given your absolute control of the planet's sky. The staffers looked at each other, clearly uncomfortable with the idea, which Antonov thought was a measure of the effect this war was having on its participants. 3 years earlier, they wouldn't have been uncomfortable. They would have been glassy-eyed with shock. The making of microorganisms to order had been a simple matter as far back as the 21st century. At first, few had appreciated the horrific potentialities of the gin crouching within the shiny new bottle. But a few very close calls had brought humanity to the realization that, as Howard Anderson had once remarked, a nuke is just a big bubblegum pop by comparison. The problem, of course, was microbe susceptibility to mutation, combined with their eye-blink-brief generations. Tailored bioweapons could evolve out from under whatever limitations had been engineered into them with terrifying speed, and the youthful Federation had decided with rare unanimity that the djinn must never be let out. The matter had been beyond debate for centuries, and the Orions, on whose original homeworld it had been let out, were even more emphatic.
Well, Antonov said gruffly, with Lord Talfon running the Joint Chiefs, I know any experiments along these lines will be conducted under extreme safeguards. We'll send expeditions down to collect your specimens. But now, he continued in a tone that closed the subject, the Harna issue is out of our hands. We need to turn to the question of Second Fleet's next move.
De Berthollet looked alarmed.
Surely, Admiral, there can be no question. Once again, we've had our avenue of advance marked out for us by retreating bugs, and the recon drones have confirmed there are no fortresses guarding the next system. It must be an uninhabited system, which doesn't rate large-scale fixed defenses.
Still, Koslov said dubiously, the drones also indicate the bugs have been surrounding the warp point with minefields and laser buoys, and the mobile forces we drove out of this system have been reinforced up to somewhat more than their original strength.
In absolute terms, yes, de Berthollet retorted. But relative to our forces, including the reinforcements Admiral Moreno's brought, they're weaker than they were.
He turned back to Antonov with a look of urgency.
Admiral, the enemy can't fail to recognize the threat Operation Pesthouse represents. They would surely have poured in more reinforcements to contest our next transit, if they could.
This is just more of the same argument you used when we entered this system, Koslov protested.
And it's just as valid as it was then. Either we're in a poorly defended frontier region, as we originally theorized, or...
A feverish gleam of excitement entered his eyes.
They're so heavily committed on the established fronts that they're coming to the end of their resources. If the former, then we should press on and gain as much ground as possible before reinforcements finally arrive from their main bases, as ours finally arrived in the Romulus chain. If the latter, then they have no massive reserves left to place in our path.
Stovall spoke in his slow, deliberate way.
I find myself in agreement with Armand, Admiral. In light of what we've seen here, we have a moral responsibility to pursue any course of action that promises a quick end to this war, and to the bugs.
Koslov shot him a surprised look, and he smiled with the self-deprecating humor that was so much a part of him.
Yes, I know, we North Americans have always been suckers for anything marketed as a moral responsibility. But look at it from the narrowly tactical standpoint. Here we have a significant force of bug capital ships, which, since they have command data link, must be among their newest construction or retrofits. And we're in a position to annihilate them.
Actually, Commodore, Antonov said in the quiet voice that often surprised people, I'm less interested in annihilating them than in forcing them to retreat.
He smiled into their surprised faces.
You see, I still want to see which way they retreat. While I'm not yet prepared to let myself believe in Commander de Berthollet's second possibility, I am firmly convinced the bugs are in retreat towards their centers of population.
He paused, then spoke as much to himself as to the others.
I've made myself remain alert to the possibility of some kind of trap, even more than I ordinarily would, given the alienness of the mindset we're dealing with. But damn it, these creatures can build starships. However weird they are, they must be rational. That's been true of every technologically advanced race we've encountered, even those whose philosophies were incomprehensible or repugnant to us, like the Rigelians, were capable of acting rationally in pursuit of those philosophies' goals. But the Bugs have now given up a planet inhabited by over 3 billion of their own race. I cannot believe rational beings would do such a thing, particularly after they initiated the saturation bombardment of planetary populations, if they had any other option. And no rational fleet commander would willingly leave this large a force in a position where it didn't stand a chance of survival.
Exactly, sir, de Berthollet urged. They aren't strong enough to stop us. But 66 capital ships and 36 light cruisers are too much for anyone to consider expendable.
Still, Admiral, Kosloff spoke up, I'm worried about the possibility of flank attacks. It's a danger that grows as we advance further into enemy space. The latest news from Anderson 1 should remind us of that.
What?
Antonov looked up, blinking away his preoccupation.
Oh, yes, the third warp point our survey turned up. They're reasonably certain they've found all the warp points that there are to be found, correct?
Yes, sir.
Well, then we'll take most of the ships off survey operations in Anderson 1 and form them into a flotilla to explore the warp chain beyond this new warp point. We'll make sure we won't be taken by surprise.
Kosloff looked worried. I'd hoped we could bring some of those ships forward to join us here in Anderson 2, sir. With all our present survey assets occupied searching this system for warp points, we won't have many survey-equipped craft to take with us into the next one.
De Berthollet waved the point aside.
Let's worry first about fighting our way into it. Anderson 3, I suppose we'll call it. Plenty of time for survey after we're in possession.
I suppose so, Kosloff said, not sounding altogether convinced.
Antonov only half heard the exchange. He was examining the problem from every possible angle, seeking any sources of danger he'd missed. For the life of him, he couldn't think of any. Unless... But no, such a mentality was simply inconceivable.
The dark, silent ships hung in space, awaiting the arrival of the enemy, who had, unbeknownst to them, named this system Anderson 3, this system that the ships were destined never to leave. But that was a matter of no moment to them. That it could even be a consideration was simply inconceivable.
Chapter 36. I Want Them to Escape. Ivan Antonov's recon drones had told him of the dense minefields that surrounded the emergence warp point in Anderson 3, and of the 57 heavy cruisers that covered those minefields. So he knew how intense an SBM Hawk bombardment was needed to burn a path through those defenses for Second Fleet. The drones had also confirmed that the enemy's heavy units were being held well back from the warp point. As usual, that placed them outside SBM Hawk range, but Antonov didn't mind, for it allowed him to revive a classic tactic of carrier warfare. This time, the first ships to enter the hostile system were Admiral Tathanak's assault carriers. The instant carbon and silicon-based brains had reoriented themselves from the wrongness of warp transit. The electromagnetic catapults flung scores of fighters into space. Then the CVAs executed a tight turn and began vanishing back into the warp point from whence they'd come. Once back in Anderson 2, they would turn again and re-enter Anderson 3, where their fighters would presumably be ready for rearming after fulfilling their task of covering the emergence of the subsequent assault waves. It was the sort of maneuver which would have been flatly impossible in the days of reaction drives. Even today, such a turning radius was beyond the capabilities of any other ships in the new supercarrier's size range, super-dreadnoughts and the very largest freighters. But the maneuver worked, and the super-dreadnoughts of Task Force 22 emerged into the unaccustomed environment of friendly, controlled space. They faced an enemy who was behaving very oddly.
Gunboat deployments were promptly detected, and TF-22 braced itself for kamikaze attacks. But none came, and the bugs hung back in uncharacteristic hesitation while the bulk of Vandergelder's ships, including Colorado, transited unmolested. Only then did they close to long missile range. Antonov had expended almost all his fourth-generation SBM Hawks to clear the warp point, but he retained a substantial reserve of third-generation pods. These now transited and came under TF-22's control. They went far toward redressing the balance between 56 bug super dreadnoughts and about 30 Terran ones, but the former did have command data link now. "Admiral," de Berthollet suggested after a time, "should we order the fighters to attack in support of the battle line?"
"Yet," Antonov answered absently. He knew what was bothering the ops officer. The initial missile exchanges had favored Second Fleet, but those loss ratios included the results of the SBM Hawk increment to TF-22's firepower, and couldn't be expected to continue after the missile pods were gone. Still... "No," he repeated, "for now we'll continue to hold them back as a shield against gunboat attacks. It's too soon to risk heavy fighter loss. Admiral Tathanak's carriers are due back shortly, in conjunction with Admiral Prescott's ships. When we have our entire carrier strength in this system, it will be time to launch a massive coordinated strike."
Time wore on, and the anticipated gunboat attack failed to materialize. But the shift in the statistics of carnage after the SBM Hawk ceased to be a factor was as per expectations. The bugs were playing it very cagily, keeping the missile duel at long range and drawing back gradually as more and more Terran super dreadnoughts emerged. Antonov sensed a mood he didn't like on the flag bridge, a kind of nervous incomprehension of such a radical departure from the bugs' normal, suicidal eagerness to close to the shortest possible range. As Tathanak and Prescott's carriers transited one by one, he found himself fretting as well. But the delay gave de Berthollet time to coordinate with TF-23 ops, and it was a very purposeful wave of over 700 fighters, Antonov was still holding back his defensive screen, that streaked away towards the silent black ships. They encountered a nasty surprise. Bug gunboats in a purely defensive stance. The small craft drew as much blood as possible with her externally mounted anti-fighter missiles, then pulled back into a defensive envelope around their capital ships. Strictly defensive formations were rare in space warfare, and this proved to be a very strong one. Frustrated, stung by their losses, and still under orders to avoid excessive losses while still in Anderson III's outer system, the fighters withdrew for rearming. That operation reminded Antonov of a possibly decisive advantage that still remained to him. If he only exploited it. He proceeded to do so, ordering Second Fleet to press the missile duel, allowing the bugs no respite in which to shut down their drives in order to rearm the gunboats. So it was with their internal weaponry alone that those gunboats faced a fresh assault by fighters laden with missiles and freed of their earlier tactical constraints. Tathanak's pilots went relentlessly in, the humans hurling missile strikes at the gunboats while their Ophiuchi comrades covered them against the anticipated counterattack by those gunboats. But the bugs stubbornly refused to be drawn out of their defensive hedgehog, and the Ophiuchi were denied the dogfighting at which they were the acknowledged masters. Instead, the fighters pressed their attack home into the defensive envelopes of the bug capital ship's massive energy weapons and numerous missile launchers, grimly accepting whatever losses it took to blast the gunboats out of the equation. And, de Berthollet concluded his report to a hastily convened staff meeting, "the last of the squadrons have reported in or are accounted for. They are all en route back to their carriers, and the loss figures can be regarded as definitive." He indicated the columns of color-coded numbers on the display screen of the small conference room just off Colorado's flag bridge. Antonov eyed those figures with scant favor. He'd been forced to jettison his original guidelines for what constituted acceptable fighter losses, and he didn't like it. Still less did he like the way the bugs, sans gunboats but still formidable, were continuing to be coy.
Their tight formation held back just outside missile range, 5.5 light hours from the K-type primary star of this undistinguished binary system whose details the probing RDs were gradually filling in on the plot. They'd already ruled out any high-tech population centers, and Antonov caught himself sighing with relief that there'd be no Harna here. He shook the thought aside and glared anew at the red eye.